despite there being 100,000 things on that storefront, right? That you look at it for a while, you're like, I don't want to see any of this.
Yeah, there's that moment of feeling like there's just nothing to watch.
Yeah.
As you're staring at a screen full of stuff. Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 269 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games program.
I'm Adam, and I'm slowly roasting.
I'm Sam. Yeah, it's hot. There's no AC when you're podcasting. It's hard time.
It's hot. This is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is July 24th, 20 Blundy. Before we get started, we have a warning. There's going to be swears in this show. So buckle your ear holes.
Buckle them open.
Buckle them open so you get the swears in there. Mm-hmm. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We grabbed their money, and we liked it. Well, thank you very much. All right. We got some updates about some stuff that we talked about last episode. For starters, cats. Kittens. Yes.
What is the story, Adam? Where are we at on Cat Gate?
The ongoing saga to update. We're practicing the lady who swallowed a fly principle of getting larger animals to reduce the chaos of smaller animals. We kind of did the opposite, I guess, because we got one kitten and then a smaller kitten. So we're kind of doing an inverted old lady scenario.
Sort of a Benjamin Button swallowed a fly sort of
situation. Yeah, that's the kind of thing we're doing. So we got this tiny kitten. her name is Charlie because she has this little like ink smudge nose that kind of looks like a Charlie Chaplin mustache, you know. So I mostly just refer to her as Laser Kitten because she meows it with little pew pew noises. So that's what we got. That's the situation we're in now. We got this tiny kitten. She's wearing a onesie also because she won't stop licking her neuter site. And so my wife took a sock, cut some holes in it, and made a little onesie.
Incision, right?
Yep, got like a big belly incision. Yeah. She just keeps licking it, so we just pulled that thing over, and so now she's a little kitten sausage. So anyways, we got this kitten. We got this laser kitten sausage. And the goal was to use her as a exhaustion mechanism for our other kitten, who we've now had for months. He's about a year old now. He looks like a cat, so I'm not really sure. We're a little bit too late to this game, but we know we're going to make it happen. We're going to make it work. So we're going through the very slow process of introducing them, where you like smell under the door for a while. You introduce them to each other's spaces, blah, blah, blah. But we finally got to the point where we could feed them while they're looking at each other. Right across a barrier,
it's a big moment.
I can't even eat when looking at someone else. You know? Just lose it.
It is crazy how slow this process is to do it right. So it's moving. We started this week. We've had like 3 days of it. It's been generally pretty chill with just the exception that our now older kitten, who is way bigger. He's like easily three times as big as this tiny laser kitten is. Turns out he's a little fucking wuss. He's just a little wuss. So he's totally fine for a while, and then he gets more and more nervous over time. It's like he finishes his food, and then he just starts looking, and then he kind of like backs away, and then he gets a little aggressive because apparently he's freaked out. And then then we separate them, and you know whatever. But then for literally like an hour afterwards, he's like really skittish. Like he's just been spooked so hard from seeing this tiny kitten, who I guess is the most intimidating thing in the universe. Did you see that thing? Yeah,
exactly. Making laser noise.
Yeah. It's like he saw a ghost or something, and he's just super freaked out. And so then to the point where the other cat, who he has been harassing, which is why we got this tiny kitten, he's now scared of the other cat for like the next half hour.
Perfect.
And then that's all scared of other things. Well, it does, except the way that he acts when he gets scared is he first kind of like backs away. And then if he feels like he hasn't resolved the scenario, then he goes for a face smack, which then exacerbates the problem all over again.
You need a therapy dog for this cat.
Yeah.
Yep. And if the therapy dog can't handle it, then we got to get you a peacock, you know, a therapy peacock. Because those make true laser noises where they're like,
Yeah, that's true. Pretty
sure it's what a laser sounds like.
Fuck.
Yeah. I've heard lasers. yep.
It's the sound that baby alligators make. So if any of you listening have never heard baby alligator noises, just Google it. Yeah. Go to YouTube. It is, you will hear it and you will say, no, this is not true. This is somebody audio photoshopping. This mm-hmm. is nonsense. Yep. It is the sound. There's some videos where we put up that's just like a bunch of baby alligators in a bathtub or something. I don't know, like in some little pool. And they're just all making these little weird pew pew laser noises. It's fucking amazing. And this is basically the noise that this kitten makes, which is why I refer to it as laser kitten. But if it wasn't for the fact that it's sort of like a transubstantiation of noises, right? It's like you hear laser noise from Star Wars, right? Then you hear these alligators that are close to that, but not exactly right. And then I have this kitten who's now close to this, but not exactly that. Mm. And so it's like a laser noise twice removed, right? You know?
So there's this book series that I read quite a while back. It's very stupid. It's called Star Force. It's kind of like an 80s – it's like a book version of 80s action movies.
Mm, but don't we have a Star Force now? Space Force.
We have a Space Force. But they use lasers. But one of the things that the author chose to do, which I thought was kind of cool, is treat them like normal lasers, which is they're completely silent because it's just a laser.
And also invisible probably, right?
And it's invisible, yeah. And so he's describing space battles and how it's weird because like inside the ship, you hear nothing, you feel nothing, there's no recoil. And then off on like the screen, they would see the enemy ship like a, you know, millions of kilometers away. And all of a sudden it just melts. Mm-hmm. Like nothing else. You don't see why it's melting. It just gets real hot in one spot and then a hole melts in it. And then that's the whole thing.
Yep.
That would make for a much less interesting Star Wars movie.
It certainly would. Yeah, than having the TIE fighters that roar across the vacuum of space. And
mm-hmm. Yeah. But apparently it's very bright. You know, if you're holding a laser and you're firing one that's strong enough to melt a spaceship, then you need a protective visor because it's pretty bright. So
well, I was going to say, Adam, so far, as far as how this laser cat scenario has ended up for you, we've got now you – have had to create a onesie for a cat.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
We're still in the slow intro phase, so there's some additional management overhead.
And you have puncture wounds.
You got mauled by the scared cat.
That did also happen, yep. It didn't get infected, though, so I'm going to call that a net win.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the cat, who this is all done for, is now – not attacking the original cat, but is scared and then sometimes attacking it. So we're sort of in like a – we're in like a halfway to where we need to be.
We're in some strange limbo state. Yeah, I think it's fortunate that we are trapped at home during a pandemic because now there's – I just got nothing else to do besides figure out how to make this puzzle work. So, you know, we got that going for us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I'm sure next episode we'll have
there will be more.
Yeah, there will be
next episode. She'll be out of her onesie. Also, every time we take her out of it temporarily to like clean her up and you know let her spend some time free. It's as if it's like the opposite of when you have caffeine and you take energy away from the next day. You know, it's like she's been building it inside of this onesie for days. And then that little fucker will just run. She will just run for an hour. It's just like running and leaping for a whole hour.
Now that the onesie's off.
Now that the onesie's off. Like she's like panting the whole time. And you would think at any moment she's going to like keel over dead. But no, she can still jump on you. Like she is going to do it. It is it's very weird. So things are going to be very different once she like gets into some sort of more normal state. She also gets very angry and makes a lot of laser noises at you as you're putting the sweater or the onesie back on.
Yeah, man, you're containing, you're constrainer.
Yeah, you know? She hates it, and so there's a lot of just sort of general anger also involved. So it'll be much better once we get this fucking onesie off.
Yeah, great.
Wild time.
Wild time.
Yeah. So also last episode we talked about. The what did we call it? The tech debt
burn down rodeo circus.
Rodeo circus, namely transitioning the entire portfolio of games over to Rumpus and sort of bringing them up to date, so that we can once again patch them, keep them from crashing. You know, you name it, all those things, all those good things. So last episode, I had said that by now we would probably be done with Roid Rage and Flop Rocket. And we are.
Nice. So
those are we don't have the in-app purchase butter up hooked back up, but you know, we'll figure that out at some point. And so now it's on to Quadrupus Rampage. And then last is Talphite, and then it's done.
So
they're all done.
You know, so you've been working through these in the reverse order in which we built them. So you're working backward in time.
Sort of drilling into
our stupidity, really. So tell us, what have you found?
Yeah, right. It's like an ice core where you're measuring CO2, except we're measuring stupidity as you,
yeah.
As
yeah.
you go down it's the layers. It's been super fun. So we just finished working on Levelhead, which is, of course, 2-year project, enormous, 90,000 lines of code, biggest project we've ever made. Uses Rumpus, all the new web tech. It's very modular, very easy to update, all that stuff. Next was Crashlands that I worked on to get Rumpus into, which was the game before Levelhead, right? And it took two and a half or three weeks to get things migrated to Rumpus, because it was mostly just broken in lots and lots of different places. There's this principle in programming called dry violation. Dry is don't repeat yourself, right? Mm-hmm. And so a majority of that 3-week period was me finding all these places where code was basically copy pasted, and then turning that into like reusable stuff. Roid Rage and Flop Rocket were pretty easy to work with. But by the time I got back to Quadrupus is where shit starts to get real.
Mm.
So the big – I think probably the easiest way to explain the difference in programming is that Quadrupus Rampage's cloud save syncing is originally 890 lines of code. Okay.
After the Rumpus
transition, it's 17. So there's just so much happening in that game. And also that was the first game that we made that got any kind of like a traction in terms of player base. And there are thousands of lines of code in Quadrupus Rampage of all kinds of things like trying to integrate Twitter into stuff and Facebook and cross promotion between Quadrupus and other games, like made by other studios.
And the data storage too is like we didn't really know how to think about data storage that at the time, like at all. So we're always going to be wrong in discovering, you know, 5 years downstream that we have still been dumb the whole time, right? But
oh yeah,
but we were particularly ignorant at that time about how to think about storing data. And basically, it was just sort of like we had a one-size-fits-all approach. We were just like, I have a MySQL database for bsketch.id. That's where stuff is stored. So it's just a bunch of columns of data. That's just what it is. Just a bunch of columns. And so we, in order to make that work with the stuff that we have in Quadrupus Rampage, we just used like a new column for everything. There's like 160 columns in this table of stuff. Yeah. Even stuff where if something in column A is true, then stuff in column B must be false, right? So instead of having one column that's just like which one of those two things it is, right? We have two columns that are now we had to add additional logic in the game that basically says, oh shit, if both of these are true, then like fall back to this other default or something instead, right? And right. So migrating this over to – because then we just migrated stuff straight over to Rumpus, which is then kind of annoying because there's like all this stuff we're looking at. And I'm like, we could literally collapse these 160 variables into probably like 20, I think it looks like. And it would be easier to use. It would make more sense. Oh, and then, of course, the data set would be smaller. It would be faster to update. There's like a jillion improvements that go along with this. But, of course, that would require a bunch of dev time. Backwards compatibility problems. There's no point. And so we're going to still live with this just dumb setup.
Yeah. So that's what I've been doing. And I'm even more worried about Talphite.
That's going to be something else.
Because yeah, Talphite's very funny.
So one of the things with Talphite is that at the time we didn't have the understanding or the tech to upload binary files. So all I mean by that is like take a file, upload it to the server, right?
Well, we also didn't even know how to think about binary. So we didn't even know how to think about the data in and Tau fight is basically like what rooms you've been to, which is just a bunch of XY coordinates, right? It's a perfect,
yeah,
perfect fucking scenario for really concise binary data.
Right.
Because we didn't know how to think about it. It was just numbers. Yeah. Just numbers.
Yeah. And numbers are tiny in binary.
Yeah.
No, we didn't do that. Instead, we somehow managed to convert your save file basically into a giant URL.
Yeah, basically.
Right?
Yep.
Like one really, really long URL, like a web address, and then just send that URL to the server, which would then take the URL back apart.
It's all very weird. And the way that it originally worked. So Tau fight itself has been updated a few times. So because it got updated to add bsketch ID into it, and when we had found that the normal save system in Tau fight, and I remember this back when we were updating it to add bsketch ID, whatever that was now 5 years ago or something. The saves were really slow, like crazy slow. Just the normal save without even using the internet or anything. It would take like 2 seconds, I think, which, you know, doesn't sound like a long time, but we're talking like the tiniest amount of data like possible. And it turned out it was because we were doing several thousand string like operations on the data before we could actually would save it. Just like this really weird, wacky thing we were doing. And then we had fixed that. We were so proud of it. But there's a legacy consequence, which is that because it was so slow, and then the file ended up being like so big and verbose, is we made it so that you have to manually choose to sync your save to the cloud.
Oh,
because
yeah.
we were like, this is like too slow. It's too dumb. Well, it's too big. You can't
auto-save it.
You can't auto-save it. So we'll just make this the player's problem, because the logic at the time was if we just have the players do it manually, then it'll be done as infrequently as possible. But still, it's now the player's fault if they don't sync their save, right?
I mean, it's an elegant solution for a very dumb problem.
But well, yeah. So I think the best way I can describe this is, I think we've talked at some point about the Dunning-Kruger curve on the podcast, but it's essentially the relationship between how much you actually know about stuff versus how confident you are in your expertise. Right.
Yeah, a good example in the current world is an anti-masker or an anti-vaxxer who says, I've done my research,
which is
they are putting themselves in an exact position on the Dunning-Kruger curve that you can just – they're the peak of it. You can just look right at it.
Yeah. So the way the curve works is like once you know a little bit about something, you tend to dramatically overestimate how much of the total available knowledge you have now learned, right? So if you've gotten like 1% of the information available about a thing, you might think that you have 90% of it, basically. Because mm-hmm. You've read 10 articles, and what more could there be, right? Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, of course, there are people who have dedicated their entire life to studying a particular topic.
And have no confidence at all. And
yeah, if you talk to those people, they're like, I'm even more confused than when I started. Because of course, the deeper you dig, the more you realize how many unanswered questions there are, and just how complicated it all is.
And also just how much of what we know is based on really fragile underpinnings.
Yeah. And so going back through all these games is really, you know, it's kind of like riding the Dunning-Kruger curve like a roller coaster, you know? Like I can kind of go back and see how we had so much confidence about so many of the things that we were doing. We had absolutely no idea what was going on, right? Mm-hmm. We didn't know how to do just about anything, but we did it anyway in sort of like the hackiest, most thrown together way we possibly could.
Well, it's funny if you look at how much work goes into that. Like you talk about this, you know, 800 lines of code to get the quadruped saves going when it could have been 17.
Could have been, mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, like after the Rumpus integration, Quadrupus is going to have fewer lines of code than before.
Even after integrating the entirety of the Rumpus code set.
After integrating the entirety of Rumpus.
As well as a new interface and all sorts of new stuff. Yeah, there's a bunch of new stuff.
Yeah. There. Yeah. And so I'm able to refactor the game code so concisely that the project is shrunk.
And this, of course, is only the parts of it that you're even visiting, which is a small subset of the whole thing.
I'm not even touching the gameplay. I'm not even touching the actual like core game system.
This is just
the meta level system.
Don't even touch that.
So yeah, it's been pretty fun. And honestly, it has been really cool to go back through these games as well, because you know, these games are 7 years old. And we had some really fun and cool designs and ideas from back then that we have started looking as we're doing pre-production work into Crashlands 2. You know, we're thinking about how to kind of tie some of the older games back in and stuff like that. And it's been kind of a nice refresher to be able to go back and just kind of see what those games were like.
And there's some cool stuff in those games too. Like, because I've been doing all the data migration stuff, so I'll boot up all the old games to make sure things are working and that sort of stuff. And it has been actually very fun to boot those things up and look at some of our design decisions, where I'm just kind of surprised that our past selves were clever enough to have thought up some of those things that we did. You know,
I mean, yeah, and I mean, my favorite thing is the Quadrupus Rampage Masteries.
Yeah, those are great.
Which is like, it's like they're sort of like achievements. So they'll be about a specific thing, like knock 1,000 enemies off of ledges, and once you do that thing, then the mastery allows you to choose some way to make knocking enemies off of ledges even cooler, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like a talent point tied to an achievement. It's super cool and interesting. So, Sam, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, I think it's fascinating how clever we are and how dumb in terms of, you know what I mean? Like you can, if you're dumb, you can actually get away with it by being extremely clever. But like it's, you know, you can't build certain things, like you can't take it super far, but you can get plenty done being a clever dumbass. I think it is
basically by not knowing how much trouble you've almost gotten yourself into.
Right? Yes.
It's ignorance
is bliss.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is.
It's the sort of the definition of being a person and like in humanity as a collective. Right. It's
that's
like
true.
Weird. If you look at the world around us, like we are dumb as rocks. But if you also look at the world around us.
So clever.
Those are pretty incredible things. Yeah, it's the
what's
most
the,
hilarious
what's the
contrast?
Phrase? It's like you know just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah,
yeah. Which is why anytime I'm talking to like a third party contractor or some expert in a thing that I'm like I'm a service that I'm using. Whenever they ask me about my knowledge level, I say I know just enough to mostly stay out of trouble. But that's the line I try to hit with all the technologies that I use. Right. And that's why I try to learn just enough that like I'm there and I'm kind of aware of where like the trouble boundaries are, you know? But the reality is you never know. You never know where all
you
those
never
boundaries
know.
Are.
Yeah. And so after going through all these games and just realizing just how out of date they've gotten in terms of the tech and Rumpus and all that other stuff, we want to get into a better state of mind with those and develop better practices for keeping them up to date and maintaining them. And so last weekend I was speaking to an online gaming buddy of mine who's a helicopter pilot, and he was just talking about their regulations that they have to fire up the engines on all of the aircraft every 2 weeks. So in the military, if they have airplanes, helicopters, whatever, jets laying around, if they're not being actively used, they still have to turn them on and do a maintenance check every 2 weeks. And I was like, yeah, actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Yep.
Because you don't want it to be the case that when you need the dang thing, nobody's checked it in 2 years.
You don't know its state. You don't know if it's working. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. And unfortunately, you know, that's where we've been with all these older games. And so we're going to be trying to figure out how to, you know, spin up the helicopters with much more routine frequency so that these games can be expanded upon if need be. We can loop things back in like we used to with cross-game promotion and stuff like that. So I'm very excited about this stuff. All right. Now, before we get into questions, we want to talk a little bit about Crashlands 2 pre-production and the kinds of things that we're learning from it.
Yeah. So for those – this is just a quick recap. It's the first time we're actually dedicating an intense period to the pre-production phase. And it's largely because a typical problem in a game studio is basically this issue of phased labor, which is that typically in a large game studio, you know, it costs a lot of money to have everybody on staff all the time. And so there's a tendency to, especially in the case of when you have your programmers, to always need your programmers to be programming things. And the problem is that after a project ships, there's a long period of time where actually there could be design decisions being made, frankly, a lot of decisions being made with no code going down at all. In fact, I think based on what we're learning, probably should be a long period of time where that planning phase is happening. And the issue typically is you have to figure out, like, what the fuck do we do with these programmers? So
yeah, so in a really big company, they'll just be like, oh, we've got another project we can put you onto, mm-hmm. right? In a more mid-sized company, there might be, well, we'll just fire everybody. Also, mm-hmm. big companies do that too. And then rehire people back when we are ready to spin up the next title.
Yeah.
It's a really sticky problem.
Yeah. And then as other industries handle this in a variety of different ways, right? So in the case of movies, everybody actually, like each of the different talent types is sort of like everybody shows up for a project and then leaves for a project, right? And so you don't actually have this problem because it's not like the movie itself is forming a studio to make just that movie and then has to figure out how the fuck to deal with, you know, the script writing parallels and everything else. And so games has this currently still has this weird structure that makes it very difficult where you want to keep the teams together, but that what that really means is that you actually have no capability to modulate the work because of the phase nature of game development. So what we've been able to do is because we're doing this tech debt burndown, it's given us this longer form of time. Now I think we're about like 6 weeks in or so, maybe less, to really just be focusing on Crashlands to pre-production. And so what that's amounted to is it's basically running through all of the design pillars for the game, having very regular meetings every couple of days to run through new ideas and stuff. And one of my biggest realizations, I think, is that what you should be able to do in pre-production is actually cut stuff. And so there's a lot of this idea of like when you're in the pre-production phase, there's a lot of supposed inherent risk with pre-production because, of course, ideas cost nothing and words cost almost nothing. And so that's actually mainly what pre-production is sort of getting started on that idea phase, and then you eventually get into, you know, doing some art and stuff. And so there's this fear typically that there's going to be like a big bloat where you're like, you're just going to write down all this shit. Like you've been writing checks that you cannot cash at the end of the day, right?
Which would probably be true if you were a designer who didn't know anything about what it means to implement the details.
Definitely. Or if you weren't reviewing your document repeatedly with people who do know how to implement the details.
Yeah. Right. Where everyone's goal is actually to end up doing as little work as possible for that reason. Keep scope.
That's
tight.
Always my goal.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, that's been the big finding, I think, from this past week. I think we've cut an entire faction of enemies out of the game as of about an hour ago and very casually. So just came up a couple times that like, oh, we could actually do this thing slightly differently with the story. So it wouldn't even involve these people. And then a little bit later, this other thing not necessarily needing to involve them, and then just sort of realizing, well, if those two core things don't need to involve them, then fuck them. Get them out of here. Like, yeah, that's going to save us tons of time and resources. And so really what it should be doing is you find the core through this pre-production process of the game and then should be able to answer questions such that you can actually cut things out from your original vision. And then hone things that are still present closer to that core. So we completely rewrote the story premise as well this week also. And so you keep on just like cycling around the ideas that started stuff and kind of holistically look through things. And so I'm really excited because I think we're honestly probably a week or so away from this initial design phase being complete in terms of pre-production.
And what that means there's a component too that we were talking about that we were really excited about. That I just saw a message before we started this about maybe also cutting, but which is really actually kind of an end game feature. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we're starting to consider too moving forward is just accepting the idea that no matter how good of a game we make, it may not hit the market well, right? And so if we overinvest in certain things like end game content or like having lots of different versions of something we have it all before it's out. We may find that, oh no, now we're out of money and this one didn't make any money and now the studio is closed, right? Versus basically earmarking those as like, okay, this would be very cool. So
yeah, literally here's Kickstarter stretch goals, this sort of way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, here's the list of things that assuming everything goes well, we get the game out, it gets received well, and it's making enough money that we can afford to continue developing it. Then here's these really cool features kind of already planned out and ready to go. But we won't actually invest in them now, though we will make room in the game as it gets developed today to be able to plug these new features into it, right? Mm-hmm. which is a different, like, it's just a conceptually different way of thinking about this than I have in the past. But I've been listening to a podcast called, called Live Ops, something of Live Ops.
Sure brought to us, right?
Yeah. And it's by some people from Microsoft who work on, what's it like, PlayFab or whatever. It's like a bunch of like kind of pre-baked analytics tools and stuff. And they just interview heads of studios who are largely doing free to play, so it's mostly free to play stuff. But apparently that's kind of become sort of accepted wisdom in the free to play space, which is that it's so risky to launch a thing, and you just don't know enough about how it's going to stick that you want to launch with sort of like you literally want to take the minimum viable product model, right, and get that thing out so that you can actually see if this thing could work at all. And I remember. It was a year ago, 2 years ago, we were talking about that indie studio who got a whole thing for like getting wish lists on Steam or something, where it was like, if we can't get X thousand.
It was Coffee Stain.
It was Coffee Stain.
When they made a game called Deck Splash, which was like a skate. You are a skateboard.
Yeah. You are a skateboard, yeah.
You are a skateboard, and as you skate, you leave colored paint on things.
It becomes like a Splatoon thing, right? Where you end up, it's like a territory.
Splatoon, yeah. Tony Hawk, but you are the skateboard. You're not riding the skateboard.
Right. And I remember at the time, they basically, and I can't remember exactly what their thing was, but it was something like going to early access and just counting wish lists or something like that.
They did a free weekend or something like that. Like,
they did a free weekend.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And they said, if we don't get 100,000 people over a free weekend,
then we'll assume this isn't going to be worthwhile. And at the time,
if we can't give it away.
Yeah.
Then it's bad.
and at the time, I remember we all thought like this makes a kind of sense, but none of us truly believed that this was a good enough indicator of, because we're like, hey, it's up for free, you know, it's like a partially made game.
You're never going to be able to perfectly simulate the market condition.
Yeah, it seems like it would depend. It would be too hard to actually be able to say like whether it works or not. And in either case, whether or not that would actually map onto success, you know, in the future. And I think while that is true, that'll be hard. I think it actually probably was a better indicator than I thought at the time.
Yeah, that's a perfectly fine thing to infer, I think, generally. You know, especially because like the thing is like you can look at other aspects of the analytics, right? So I think aiming specifically for like 100,000 users, in the case of free weekends, probably is really too arbitrary, because for what we've seen,
it depends too much on exposure from press exposure from Steam and all that stuff.
Yeah, so what you probably want to look at instead is what people's actual behavior is
with their attention, how likely they are if they hit your store page to actually download the game in the first place, and all that stuff.
So it's a bit of a
that's kind of a lesson that I feel like we've been trying to pull out from Levelhead as well. In looking at like other games that have launched around the same time, looking at games like Deck Splash, looking at games like Totally Accurate Battle Simulator, and some of these like bare bones early access indie games that are just like goofy physics sims, you know. I think it's hard to dispute that. People buy a game based on its core premise, not on its details.
Correct. Yeah.
Yep. Right. So if when you show your game to people, if they're not immediately like, yeah, and then down to buy it, then adding features like around the edges of the game for another 2 years will not get people more excited about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was an interesting take that Coffee Stain had in it.
And one of the other things we learned we inferred from both this pre-production phase as well as just looking back at all of our games and then doing this industry analysis is that if you have a hook, so in other words, if you have a very unique mechanic to your game, but it's not visible, literally, as in like if I'm playing the game, there's no way for you to really surface it, then you actually don't have a hook yet. I'm sad to say. What you have is just something that's interesting. But a hook is something where it's like Seth was talking about, where something that's actually functions as the core reason why someone would buy the game in a way that they can understand by looking at the damn thing, right? Because that's actually the only way you can – it's the only way. I mean, even before you play a free-to-play game, that's the thing. Like the idea that a game being free means that like you're going to get it and check it out is also inaccurate, right? Because like you'll still watch a trailer and be like, not for me. It's free. They're giving it away. And you're like, no, I'm good. Like, I don't want this.
Still too expensive.
Yep.
Yeah.
They'd have to pay me to play.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild.
Well, there was a time where I was in India. There's a lot of vendors just out and about, mm-hmm. and this man came up to me, and he was like, he had these giant balloons, huge balloons, and he was like, "Do you want a balloon?" And I'm like, "No, I don't." And he's like, "It's very cheap." And I was like, "You could pay me, and I wouldn't want this
because I don't want to have the problem."
Yeah, I was like, "I would have to carry this giant ass balloon around. What am I gonna do with this, man?" Like, mm-hmm. he kept trying to negotiate the price down, probably thinking that I was haggling, maybe. But I wasn't.
You can't tell the difference between in a haggling-based economy. You can't tell the difference between somebody truly not wanting something.
That's true.
Right? And pretending that they don't to lower the price.
I wish there was a code word you could throw out to mean like, no, genuinely, you couldn't give me this thing for free. Like, yeah. I really, really don't want it. But anyways, okay. We should get on to some questions, yeah, I think. All right, these questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Tofos, who says, "Have you ever considered publishing games made by others?"
Yes.
Yes,
yes we have.
We've considered it so many times and always thought that it would be way too much work.
Yeah. Well, so I guess having seen how much effort goes into to just a game launch, right? Because to me, publishing – because the big question here is like, what does it mean for our role actually as a publisher? Because publisher doesn't mean any specific thing. It means that you're somehow involved. It means maybe you just hand some money up. Maybe it means you hand some money out, give some milestones. Maybe it means you hand some money out, expect some money back. Maybe it means that you don't. There's no money exchange at all. You just provide some services, and then if they make money down the line, you take a percent. Like
maybe you help them put multiplayer in. Who knows?
Yeah,
maybe you do
that. Maybe you just get them in contact with the right people so that the good things can happen. The spectrum of what it means to be a publisher is so broad that the real question that we've actually been asking is what kinds of publisher services, more specifically, are things that we feel like we would be worthwhile for us to figure out how to provide. And that's where the discussion has always been. And we've talked about it a lot at various points in the studio's history. And I think that still we're the position that we're in is that when it comes to launches, the one really great thing for the studio that being a publisher would provide is the ability to have more launches, right? Instead of launching every 4 years or whatever, we now can do it every year or whatever. And so we get to maintain and develop a lot more experience with what it means to actually try to successfully launch a game. So there's that really great sort of benefit. But at the same time, the cost of a launch is so fucking high in terms of our time that it's been hard to imagine stepping into that role as a publisher in a way where we actually do end up on where we benefit as well as the person whose right. work we're helping with, right? Because we will have to do it at the expense of our normal work.
Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be making games anymore.
Yeah. And so
there's just no way.
So it's possible that there may be like, as we continue to work on our processes for how we make games and how we try to sell games, all this stuff. And as Sam was just talking about earlier, there are points in time during the game development cycle where different roles now are less needed for what's happening in the moment with the development of the game. And so what we've kind of been on the lookout for is just like over time, are there people in the studio who find themselves in that scenario for like long enough periods of time who also whose knowledge set would be sufficient for us to do things like start to spin up a sort of publishing kind of division? Similarly, are we building our tech in a generic enough way that a service that we could provide is helping people get cert ready or actually providing Rumpus as a tool that people can integrate with their games so that they can use it as an online system and all that stuff. Like, is it generic enough that we could do that in a low cost way to ourselves and that sort of thing? So I think the short of it is that we've had a fuckload of thoughts about it, but the answer has always been, that's going to be way too expensive.
Well, it's a lifestyle question, you know.
Yeah.
What do we want? What kinds of problems do we find interesting to solve? And are those the problems we'd be solving if we were a publisher? And I think we've kind of landed in a place where we are very happy with the kind of work that we do. Mm-hmm. And switching to being a publisher would be a complete 180. We'd be doing a completely different set of things. And there's a good chance that we would ultimately find those things enjoyable and interesting. But, you know, why risk it?
Why risk it? Because it would have to be done at the cost of not making games at all or just not doing it as fast. And so – and I think that the main thing is that it's hard to see – us stepping into any kind of a publisher role with the current state of our studio and with the level of success that we've had, where the trade-off would definitely be worth it and it wouldn't just be actually a very high risk.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Next question comes from Kabanga Newcrag, who said, how many episodes of the podcast do you record in advance?
One. Usually.
It's none. It's just one. It's just 5 minutes.
It's in advance, as in like we don't do it live. So
The Friday before the Wednesday.
Yeah, the Friday before the Wednesday.
Yeah, we try to keep them fresh, you know.
Yeah, if someone's going to be gone for like a week, then we'll usually like try to record two within a few days or something to have them be ready to go. But man, for the most part, it's just a few days before. Mm-hmm.
We are delivering just-in-time inventory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think over the winter break, we pre-recorded like 3 episodes.
Yes.
I think. And we'll probably kind of do that sort of thing.
We just get some whiskey and hang out? Isn't that what we did?
We did, yeah. I think we recorded 2 back-to-back on one day, and then I think 1 the next day or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the problem is like we could talk about stuff for days, but – We try to truncate things a lot for the podcast to try to keep it high level and interesting.
Yes. Right?
Because like Adam could talk about like web infrastructure and JavaScript for 39 hours if you needed him to.
No, I could talk way more than that.
But at a certain point, your vocal cords would
I'll just keep talking. You won't hear what I'm saying, but I will keep going.
You'll just hear like a weird sort of like whistle and some dust will come out. But there'll be JavaScript.
I was just thinking today about some of the cool, like weird tricks that I've been doing to make some fun stuff happen. Like there's a thing that I'm working on right now that's using a property of Git, which is our versioning thing, to make it work like a database to keep track of a specific kind of data. That I'm like so pumped about, and it's so fucking rad. But like, where am I going to go tell people about this? You know, who's going to care about this?
Six people
will care about this.
People will care. So when we do those advanced episodes, it's mostly like the first one is a normal episode, and then the second one is mostly questions, and then the third one is just sort of deranged tangents. Yeah, so
deranged tangents. Yep.
Yeah. All right. Next question comes from Beaky Bapa Boop, who says, Jason Schreier, Blood, Sweat, and Pixels author, recently said, video games are too long. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing this. I believe he was talking about it in the context – was he talking about the context of like epic sweeping, you know, single player RPGs? Or was he talking about the context of games that have no end and that want you to play every minute of your entire life?
I think the former.
Because I think it was the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because you can't really comment on the length of an endless game. It's too long, though.
You know, if it keeps on going,
that's like saying building model train sets is too long, because because it's a hobby that I've been doing my entire life.
Too long is just in general to me one of the weirdest kinds of complaints about a thing, because if it's boring, then no matter how long it is, it's too long. Yep. If it's interesting, it doesn't seem to me that there is a length that is too long.
So maybe what he's saying is games are too boring.
Yeah. Well, no, I think what it comes down to, because usually in those epic sweeping games, right? Usually there is a core story that's driving the whole thing forward. So like I can think about my time with The Witcher. I just finished God of War recently. There is a core story that's driving the whole thing forward. And so I think actually all it is, to be honest, is the fact that when you play a modern AAA game, you're actually playing a movie. And while it's very cool to have a movie that's 40 hours long, also sometimes you're like,
that's pretty long.
What I just want to know what happens, and I'm trapped for another 8 hours, you know?
Well, I think there's a related problem, which is that modern games are also padded really heavily with, which we are also guilty of side questing, right? So that, but there's a reason for this, which is to give you the feeling of having choice and agency, right?
It's actually because how you build the feeling of a world, truthfully.
Yeah, right? It's how you feel like you're in a world.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, no, it's even simpler than that. It's video games are too long so that players don't complain that they're too short.
There is like, that.
There's like, absolutely. It's such a better complaint to have about your game that it has too much stuff in it versus people being pissed off that they spent $60 and only got 29 hours of entertainment out of it, you know, when they were expecting at least 200.
Yeah, yeah.
I will say for me coming to this as a business person who makes games for a living, I agree 100% with this because the less time people are playing other games is more time they could be playing our games. And so
that's right.
Business perspective, I feel like all games are too long, and I feel like too many games are designed to be played forever.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's who we're competing with for time.
Unless they're ours, in which case they should be played forever.
We're just doing it defensively, you know what
but
I mean?
But I think this kind of gets at arms race. Which is that I think the reality in the modern landscape, I mean, this, you know, you've seen these talks with like when people ask Fortnite who they're competing with and they're like Netflix. The reality is that there's a lot of just stupidly good entertainment options. Like crazy good. And actually ones that massively overlap with the same core audience. So for example, if you're making if you want to play Disco Elysium, for example, like it's a detective story. It's an RPG. It's cool as shit. I don't know how long it actually plays for. I played it for like 10 hours. No idea. I don't think I'm anywhere near the end. So probably a long game. You could also go watch like Sherlock or something and get a similar sort of thing, right? And so I get the feel, which is essentially that you want to be able to finish a piece of content.
You want to diversify your entertainment experiences.
Yeah. And this happens with me and my wife. We're like, I don't always want to watch a show. Because I'm like, oh, God, I don't want to watch a show. I just want to have like a whole thing. Commit. Yeah. I want to have it's a whole experience in one evening. I want to
be. This is interesting, though, because I think people do fall into these two camps, but I'm not sure. Because of course, this guy was coming to this as a journalist, right? His job is to write about games.
Which means he's tired of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And if
poor guy.
Yeah, and you hear this actually with some frequency where you're especially lately where people talk about accessibility options of like being able to choose sort of the difficulty level of a game and that sort of thing, where it's not just about the people playing it because they aren't as skilled or whatever, but also because some people have less time and they want to make sure they can still experience more of the content by being able to get through it faster and so on. So there are people who argue this, right? And I think that's a real thing that definitely a lot of people experience. Mm-hmm. But my bet is that most people do not want the overhead of making the decision about what to do. I count myself in that pool of people. Every time I finish a show, I'm fucking bummed. Doesn't matter how great the ending was. Like none of that. Every time I finish a book series, fucking bummed.
Yeah. Now you're in the void.
I love things that are way too long.
Yeah, I want everything to be endless. But good the
I'm
whole time.
I'm sick of making decisions, man. Yeah. Like this is why I've been playing almost exclusively World of Warcraft since the pandemic started. Like I don't want to have to spend my evening looking at the homepage of Netflix trying to figure out what my evening's going to look like, you know? Mm-hmm. I want to know what my evening's going to look like.
You know
like.
The contours.
And that means me being an orc, punching night elves.
is just the reality. I think for most people, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for those things that they get to fall back on. Of like it's the comfortable space. They know what's going on, right? They've built up a ritual around the thing. They've got people involved who they talk to about it. Because like especially if you're interested in games, sort of games as a hobby, right? Then if you want to be able to communicate with other people about the stuff that you're doing, you have to find somebody else who also wants to play the same random miscellaneous subset of games that you're going to play. Mm-hmm. So I think, and this is one of the things that makes it so hard to be an indie game studio, is that the reality is, honestly, people are not looking for new games. Like they just really aren't that much. Mm-hmm. They're mostly playing the games that they're already playing. And it's only this like small subset. It's still a huge number of people, right? But it's a small subset of the gaming population who like plays more than one or two games and who is actively looking for mini games throughout the year. And I can't remember, it's been a long time since I saw those numbers, but I remember Steam had at one point put out like some data, or no, it was Steam Spy, about like how many games users actually own. right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's obscene. It's like there's a small percentage that actually owns most of the games on Steam, right? And then everybody else plays one or two games.
They literally play like one or two games.
Yeah.
And so if you look at like, cause so Steam is always like, you look at the huge numbers and people are looking at Steam as a market. We're like, well, Steam has, you know, 10 million daily active users and all this stuff. But if you look at what those users are doing,
yeah,
like something like 6 million of them are playing the top five games.
They're playing Grand Theft Auto 5.
Yeah, Grand Theft Auto 5 and Team Fortress 2.
How many daily active shoppers?
Yeah, because that's what actually matters. And it's going to be
a team.
Yeah, there's like 10 people. It's a tiny, tiny fraction. So I think this is actually – this is the root of the problem of why it is so hard to successfully make and sell games is that – and we made this joke a long time ago, right, where we said, what was it? We're making a product that nobody needs.
Correct.
Right? So like Seth had this in a talk somewhere. Mm-hmm. There's like some – sequence of things. But the point being, like, there's infinite alternatives. Nobody needs it. And the most important bit is that nobody's even looking for it, really, right? And yeah. So it's a bit of a hard sell. Yeah. The reason that it works is because we live in the era of the internet, and there are just enough people, just period, that even though there's that tiny, tiny subset who actually could even possibly in a million years mm-hmm. actually see that your game exists and then also say, oh, I want to try this thing out. That could be enough people, depending on the game and the timing, right, to support a small indie team.
Yep.
So that's the world that we've decided.
Yeah. Well, I think the funny thing about that comment too is the reality is like there's a shitload of absolutely fantastic short games that do exist. So this is one of the things I'm gonna be 100% honest. Like hearing reviewers in particular say shit like this makes my blood fucking boil because of exactly what you just said, which is that being an indie, being a standout indie, really hard, right? Really fucking hard. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of small games. I just played a short hike. I just played that a couple weeks ago. Absolutely phenomenal. How about instead of being like games are too long when in reality there's like 1,000 games that are probably under 4 to 5 hours that are absolutely beautiful and stupidly good.
There are way more short games than there are long games.
Also, yes, but think about this way too. More. Like, let's say
you're complaining. Go look it up, man.
Let's say, what if you're a reviewer and you've got 40 hours in a week, you know, in a work week? You're gonna spend. I don't really know what the breakdown. Let's just say it's 50-50. Half the time writing, half the time playing. I don't. Does that seem
sure? I don't know.
Reasonable. So a game like A Short Hike, maybe you're gonna play an app for an hour. And like you're going to get out of it what you need, get a good sense for the game. There's not a whole lot else going on, and then you move on with your day. Are you going to play 20 games this week?
Well, here's a better question for you.
Are you going to – that's insane. Are you going to do that?
A better question is it remotely possible for a short game to create as big of a wave and as big of an enduring fan base as a long game? Because literally the answer is no. Because guess what?
There's nothing to endure around.
Yeah, I played Short Hike a single day, a single afternoon, right? So my experience
with that – did not become a part of your life.
Well, not only that, but like my experience with that doesn't even overlap with – it overlaps with like a couple hundred people's experiences of that, right? There's not – it's not like Animal Crossing, right? You see this currently with Animal Crossing. There's so many people still playing the fucking game and you see all these pictures.
Yeah,
if the game only took 4 hours to play – that like it's not possible for that big sort of wave.
You don't have the overlap of the community actively playing.
Which also means that as a journalist, there is no incentive for you to write about short games. There's not.
Because nobody wants to read about them.
There's not enough people.
One of the core problems that we have with Crashlands as a game is that since it's a single player game and most people, even though there's a 30-hour possible story in there, most people basically they start playing it kind of randomly and they play it for maybe like a few hours at a stretch and then they may or may not come back to it and actually continue playing. And so what this means is that the number of players that you need to have a good concurrency so that there are a bunch of people who mm-hmm. actually form a active community, because an active community requires multiple people thinking and caring about the thing at the same time, right? Is remarkably difficult versus say like Levelhead, where Levelhead actually has far fewer, partially because of time, but has far fewer overall number of players compared to Crashlands, right? Mm-hmm. But the community is far more active, way more active than Crashlands ever was, because the people who are playing it get to keep on playing it and keep on finding new content and keep on sharing stuff with each other. Mm-hmm. And they get to create this ongoing community because there's so much stuff to, or so much time that they can spend that overlaps with other people's time.
Yep. There's a lot of stuff to consider.
I think
I honestly think video games should be super long, and I think they need to be super long.
I think they have to be to be successful, kind of, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the general
sense. And there's, like Sam's talking about a short hike. Like there's – or maybe it was like Monument Valley. There's exceptions for these things, but it's been kind of interesting seeing things like Apple Arcade come out. Mm-hmm. You know, they filled up their initial roster with lots and lots of
all sorts of weird stuff, cool stuff, and short things. Yeah,
lots of these small 30-minute, experiences.
Or a few hours. So,
yeah. But now what you're seeing is a lot of people are rolling out of that service because they're like, yeah, I played a bunch of these short games and kind of got my fill and
the money makers on the platform are the ones that people get to keep on playing forever.
Yep. Yeah, because of course, like, why would you keep subscribing to something when you've already like sampled and played through all of the things that you cared about, as opposed to having a thing in that subscription service that you can just keep coming back to day after day after day after day.
Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But there's a reason why once you finish watching a thing on Netflix, that despite there being 100,000 things on that storefront, right, that you look at it for a while, you're like, I don't want to see any of this.
Yeah, there's that moment of feeling like there's just nothing to watch.
Yeah,
yeah, as you're staring at a screen full of stuff. Yeah,
because there isn't for you actually, right, in that moment, because the stuff that aligns with your interests is actually a tiny, tiny subset of all the stuff that's available.
Yeah, all you want truly is more of the thing you just had.
Yep.
So there's your answer for that journalist question.
Yeah. All right, last question comes from PS7 Cho, who says, what's one food you couldn't bear to live without?
To live without?
I'm going to go.
This is a different question than just your favorite thing. This is like the one thing that if you never got to have it again,
you couldn't bear.
You'd be miserable
to live without it.
Let's remove survival based goods. I don't want to hear, I don't want to hear salt from you.
Yeah.
Clever sodium people, target
water.
Let's see. Couldn't bear. I honestly could bear to live without basically everything. I'm gonna be 100%.
Yeah, I don't give a fuck.
As far as things that I would be, I'm just gonna we're change a little bit. What would you just be bummed if you couldn't have anymore? If someone
actually
like,
maybe do it this way.
If the doctor was
what are the things that
you're allergic to this now?
Honestly, right. I still don't care. I had the thing like around the time I turned 29, like my guts were just hurting all the time. And I'm like, maybe it's a lactose thing. So I stopped consuming dairy, no ice cream, no cheese, no pizza, basically no dessert, period. Cause all dessert is made of milk pretty much.
Cause it's delicious.
Didn't affect my mood even 1%. It's fine. Who cares?
I think maybe the way to think about this then is what is a thing that you begin to crave, like truly crave if you haven't had it for a long period of time?
I only crave things. Nah, I only crave things because I know that they're available. Like if I suddenly don't have the option to have something, then
it's like removed from your radar.
Yeah, it's just it's out of sight, out of mind, right? Like I think there's a reason why people say if you're trying to lose weight, then you should like don't have snacks in the house, mm-hmm. right? Because like once they're not there anymore, then you're dramatically less likely to have the craving for the thing because the triggers are gone, right?
Adam, what about you? So, is there a thing that every so often you're just like, I need
there are a few things get, like, that every once in a while I just have to. Yeah, I have to suddenly just go buy something every once in a while. Those are basically extra toasty Cheez-Its is one of those two things. And then some form of candy. It usually is kind of nonspecific, and I decide once I get there. But there's every once in a while, it's just like I need – the only thing I want in this universe is some fucking candy. And actually the most recent one, though, is not one that I was craving in the absence of seeing it, like being aware that it existed. But it was when we were at a Chinese grocery store last weekend, and as we were walking down the aisles, I just like out of the corner of my eye saw this instant coffee. It's a Vietnamese like instant coffee thing, and It's a substance that I've had a lot. I discovered it when I first was visiting my wife's family because they didn't have any coffee in the house, but I had this stuff, and they were like, because they knew I needed some coffee, so they were like, just have this thing, and I was like, what is this nectar of the gods, you know? And so I was like hooked on it really hard for a long time, and then I had to get off of it because caffeine was like hurting me so badly. And it's been a long – I haven't had one in probably a couple of years or something, like a long time, and I saw it, and then there was suddenly – nothing Ooh. In the universe that I wanted more than that. Like, no, like literally,
again,
it's the hardest it's the I've ever craved yeah. anything. I was just like, I need, and it was like 3 PM. We brought it home, and I absolutely could not have caffeine that late. But I was still like eyeballing it. Like, we're still really, like, really wanting to. And the next morning, then I was like, so excited. I got up and I was excited when I got up to have this substance. And I mixed myself up a cup, and it was the most delicious thing I had ever had, like in that moment. It was just like it was the best intersection of a craving and then resolving that craving that I think I've ever experienced.
Yeah, as far as
the hilarious thing, of course, is after that is then the next day I had it again, and I was like, this is fine, I guess.
Yeah, this is whatever.
Yeah, I think a good way to think about that question is basically what if you walked by it in the store just cripples you in terms of like.
Yeah.
You either have to get it or have to be like
– And for me, it's very situational. It's like there's some things that I always get, right? Like when I walk by it, I'm like, oh, yeah, I definitely want to get – like for me, like I love black licorice. So it's like when I walk by it, I'm going to get me some of that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. There's like a few things like that I'll always get. But for the most part, like I don't really care. I'm not very excited about it, you know, whatever. But it's just every once in a while, there's like a thing. It's like for me, sometimes it's ice cream. Sometimes it's like – yeah, sometimes there's an overlap where like just in the moment – that is the thing. And it's, and to me, it's never been like the like one thing. There's always just like some random
rotating cast.
One time I really wanted Oreos. I don't even like Oreos that much. But one time I was just like, I just fucking need some of these.
People are so dramatic about food. You know,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like probably a year ago, I might have said meat, but I'm a fucking vegetarian now. So
yeah, same.
Even that, it turns out even that I don't care. I think as long as I have nutrition, you know, or maybe here's the thing. When it comes to like bearing to live without, maybe if you just think in terms of convenience, because if wheat or like, so like if I couldn't get like bread or tortillas, it'd be really annoying,
mm-hmm.
you know, like it'd be really annoying to figure out what to make and how to eat food. If I couldn't put it between buns or wrap it in something.
There you go. I got one finally. Eggs. That's it. I would be so annoyed if I couldn't eat eggs. Good God.
I'm bored. It's like, dude, I haven't had eggs.
Oh my God. It's just like the best. You haven't had eggs in a long time?
I haven't had eggs in like 2 months. Not for vegetarian reasons. I just didn't.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's the thing. I know it's possible. It's totally possible.
People are adaptable. You know, something stops being available. You're like, all right, well, this just, I'm not going to have that now. And then once you do see it, then all of a sudden, you, like Adam said, then nothing matters more in the universe than getting that thing.
Yeah, but it is funny though how every once in a while, just like things line up just right, where something is, it is just the thing that you need right now.
Just hits you.
It's the McRib.
Yeah. Yep.
It's the McDonald's knows this. Dude, have you had a McRib?
No.
Yep.
It's fine.
It's not ribs. It's basically it's like a meat.
It's a meat it's patty like a in the vague shape thing. Of ribs. Yeah,
it's in the vague shape of ribs, and they just kind of like cook it and slather some sauce on it, and it's fine. But it's scarce, so they get to capitalize on the on the cravings. All right. Well, I hope that answers the question. Yeah, maybe. All right, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to everything you could ever want out of life. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.